Welcome back to TRP.
Hi. A warm welcome back to the Rosslare podcast. I do hope you have a great weekend, and now we're about to listen to Mick Wallace and Claire Daly with their final podcast before the summer break.
Okay, hello, 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 and welcome back to I Perceive Trouble with Daly and Wallace. This is our last episode of the summer, I think, isn't it? Because the Parliament's going to close now for the summer recess. We'll be back in September.
All the old lads are on holidays next week. Yeah. Our colleagues in the Vox are...
A huge thank you to our production team and recording people who do all the hard work.
We'll be here for a few days next week. I mean, the likes of Francois and them, they just can swanny off now. They don't give a damn.
The world is poorly divided.
Somebody has to keep running Europe, you know.
It's hard to get rid of the two of you around here. You're bopping around all the time. That's true anyway. So you'll be here around the summer a bit anyway. But we'll be back in September. But anyway, thanks for listening. We have a nice faithful listenership, and it's nice when we hear from you and you get in touch and let us know how things are going. Today's episode, we're going to talk about completely new subjects. We're going to talk about Syria, Cuba, China, fake news, all this kind of stuff. But let's kick off with Syria, because you did a special episode last week on Echo Chamber, which people will know is a popular podcast in Ireland. You were talking about Syria and your trip and all this spotlight that's been even under now the past while for your trips. What do you make of the...
Look, and thanks to Tony and Martin, like, the guys are really well respected, and it was very sound of them to have us on, and we do appreciate that. There were maybe some issues, I suppose, that some people who've been to Syria have kind of said, why did they make a big issue about, like, that there's some sort of problem in going to Syria, people had said to me. And of course, there is no problem in going to Syria. And I suppose the first point I want to correct, and actually my sister got on to me, my sister was somebody who has organised many trips to Palestine, to the West Bank, and that in solidarity with the Palestinian people. And she actually made the point that, like, you know, if you want to go to Palestine, you just book a flight, you turn up at the airport and you get a free visa. That's it. And similarly, Syria is the same. If you want to go, book a flight, okay, can't get to Damascus, although you can some ways now, but not from Europe with the sanctions. But we don't expect people to go via, you know, Abu Dhabi or, you know, St. Petersburg or something. But you can go to Beirut and then get a visa there and organise transport from there. So if people are interested in going to either of those countries, they are open for business. You can go pretty much where you like. And if people want to do that, they should get in contact with us. It was one of the more interesting feedbacks. The other interesting feedback was we got some communication from Irish people living in China. And I thought that was really good, because there's a point we actually made on the podcast. And when we've spoken out on these issues before in the European Parliament to try and counterbalance the assault on Russia and China in particular, invariably we've been contacted by Irish people who live in these countries who say, listen, lads, you're totally right. The narrative is completely different. And you had a really good communication, Mick, didn't you, from a guy who doesn't want to be named, but he gave us a really insightful experience into what life was like for him in China.
Yeah, go on there.
Yeah, it was mad. Like, I mean, it was so refreshing to hear. Similarly, I just read the start of his letter, right? It was actually a real long letter, and he wrote it to the Tartai Shack, the two boys that did the podcast, Echo Chambers. Yeah. That was called. And he says, "Hi lads, I'm a long time listener and patron. I enjoy your chat with Mick and Claire. I'm an Irish citizen from Dublin, living in China for about a year now. I came to China with my wife to teach with an open mind and have tried to educate myself as much as possible about the political dynamics in the country regarding the Chinese Communist Party, Hong Kong, and the issues in Xinjiang regarding the Uyghurs. It's a lot to cover in one message, but I would echo much of what Mick and Claire had to say, and I must say I have had a total change of perspective while living here. I'm not saying everything is paradise. There are aspects of the control the Chinese Communist Party impose on the population that are certainly unsettling, but I think a lot of the time the Chinese Communist Party are their own worst enemies in how they present themselves externally in terms of rhetoric, and because the state have direct control over many aspects of life here, particularly the internet, some are quick to paint it as an Orwellian dystopia, when in reality Western governments have just as much access to citizens' personal information, exactly, if and when they really need it, as just as the Communist Party in China have. I mean, No, he went on to more or less say that he was actually he's actually really fond of the place, and he, I mean just on he just touched on a few of the different aspects. It's a real long letter, but he says just
and we're going to reproduce it on social media as well because it's going to be really informative for people.
And he says the hypocrisy he says around Hong Kong. Now we've pointed out already, not one protester has died in Hong Kong at the hands of the Chinese police, and we've had five. Debates in the European Parliament since we got here on Hong Kong. In the last 3 months alone, 77 protesters have been killed in Colombia by the police. 77 protesters been killed, and the European Union has no problem with it, and there's been no protester killed in Hong Kong. And this guy points out, he says, Hong Kong, he says, was under UK rule for 155 years. At no point in that time did they run it as a democracy. On the contrary, it was run with an iron fist. Yet, as soon as they left, they started to insist that Hong Kong be run as a Western-style democracy. And he says, China has a right to run Hong Kong as it sees fit. And he says, on Xinjiang, he says, there were a series of Islamic terrorist attacks in China between 2009 and 2015, similar to those experienced in the US and Europe. These attacks were carried out by Uyghurs who had been radicalized in Afghanistan, where people should remember the US actually funded and supported the Mujahideen, which is where we got our Al-Qaeda from, which began in the early 80s. Anyway, he goes on to say, China had as much right as the US or EU to try and solve this problem, which was arguably bigger for China, as they have a huge ethnically Muslim population within their borders close to Afghanistan. He says the US and EU have dealt with Islamic terrorism through a prolonged occupation of several Middle Eastern countries, committing mass genocide in the process. At least three US presidents this century, plus a UK prime minister, should have been locked up for war crimes perpetrated in this period. The US themselves had Uyghur Islamists blacklisted as terrorists as recently as 2018. Now, I mean, we know that there's repression of Uyghurs in the Xinjiang area. And we wouldn't agree with them, and we think the Chinese have handled it badly. But I mean, the manner in which the European Parliament is dealing with it, the manner in which Irish media has dealt with it, is off the Richter scale. They're not actually researching anything at all.
I think the really good parts of his communique was his descriptions about what life was like there, how he was sitting in an internet cafe in an artisan coffee shop or craft beer shop, that how foreign goods were readily available, how loads of Chinese leave China, but they come back, like that if it was a repressive state, all that kind of thing wouldn't be happening. He talked about how Muslim children in some of the schools were given halal meals, even when there were only a small number of them, and that this isn't obviously an approach akin to genocide, even though there may be some repression of Muslims, the Uyghur minority, which obviously we don't condone and would be concerned about, but it's certainly not a genocide. So I think we're going to put it up on our social media outlets, because it's a really important rebalancing, and we have to see it in the context of the drive to alienate China. We had it again this week in the Foreign Interference Committee, in the CEDA Committee, about Chinese interference. You know, say China is buying up European infrastructure. This is interference. You go, no, it isn't. It's the consequence of privatization. I mean, France owns half of Britain's rail network. Is that foreign interference? No, it's capitalism, you know, and they're to blame.
He also points out that in his letter that he says, talking about the people that are in detention in Xinjiang, he says in the USA, he says there are 2.5 million people in prison, and 1 in 20 of them are black. So 1 in 20 black Americans are locked up, and the country has the highest incarceration rate of its own citizens in the world. A quarter of all the world's prisoners are in America. And over 90% of them don't get a trial. They're pushed into plea bargaining. Do you want to admit guilt and get 5 years, or do you want to go to court and get 25 and lose anyway? Over 90% do not get a trial. And I mean, and the Americans and the EU doesn't say a word. the Irish press, nowadays it's not all the Irish press are the same, but I mean, those that don't do their research and don't understand what's going on in these places, I mean, really, it's a bit disappointing.
Let's talk about all that then in the broader context, because looking at this barrage of articles written about you the past few days, this whole thing of the two of you, like, toeing the line of all these authoritarians or whatever, do you know, what is it that you're trying to do here with the messaging? Like, what's your key message on all this foreign affairs stuff? And what's the rebalancing that needs to be done in Irish media there?
Well, it's just very important, and it shows the massive influence by the political establishments across Europe and the mainstream media to demonise China and Russia as a justification, essentially, for war. Now, that doesn't mean that they're going to go into active combat tomorrow, or not saying that. But if you want to up your military expenditure, then you have to have an enemy. And that is the backdrop to this, that for the first time ever now, the European Union, directly from its own budget, is spending money on defence. And it's not defence, because it's actually provocative. You know, it's not. So really, I suppose what we're saying is that, and it's actually quite shocking, that what we're arguing for is diplomacy, for cooperation, for dialogue. There's many countries that don't like what other countries do, but the only way in which you'll resolve them is by sitting down and talking to people. Even people who you don't like, you've got to do that, because military action doesn't resolve anything. And all of this weaponry and all of this hardware, if it's been bought, then inevitably it will be used. And ordinary people will suffer around the world. People will be dislocated in the Middle East. They end up on the shores of Europe. I've just run from a meeting where we talked about Frontex, the European Coast Guard, which is now the biggest funded agency in the European Union. It's going to be in receipt of 757 million euros to police our borders. This is an agency riddled with crisis in terms of human rights abuses, financial irregularities and so on. And yet we're pumping more money in to keep vulnerable people out who have a right to claim asylum. And the only reason why they're being trying to come here in the first place is because US foreign policy support by the EU has forced them out of their homes in the first place. So what we're trying to do is argue for international diplomacy, for peace, for an end to that sort of jingoistic war-driven agenda, which is the backdrop to all of this demonisation of Russia and China.
And I should add that I actually did an interview with the Western People last week, and it was only published there yesterday. And a guy called Pori Byrne did it, right? And do you know what? It's actually... it's revived my faith in journalism, that it is actually possible to talk to a journalist and he doesn't actually put his own spin on it, and that he didn't put a US imperialism spin on it. He put questions to me and I answered them, and he has it all in the article, and he didn't doctor it to suit a US imperialism line, which was fair play to him, and it was really refreshing.
Yeah, I mean, Daniel Murray from the Business Post interviewed us as well, and while he did repeat some of the allegations and all of that and put them to us, he did print our replies on that as well. Yeah, and that's all we asked, because some of the other stuff actually was quite sinister in terms of the scale of it. It was very bizarre because it didn't make any sense. It was totally over the top, and what you had was kind of creative journalism, as in gutter journalism, where a big pile of stuff that we'd said was all chopped and copied and pasted and put together to make it sound like madness. And the same people writing those articles couldn't be bothered covering the whole plethora of issues that we raise here in this parliament.
I mean, one perfect example was, it was actually the particular journalist we were referring to actually said, I mean, Mick Wallace, he even said that the Americans were involved in the coup in Ukraine in 2014. My God, this is obviously Russian fake news. He was following the Russian line on it. Now, I mean, just for the record, for anyone that's interested, right, and you can check this for yourselves, don't necessarily believe me, but in actually, WikiLeaks revealed a phone conversation between Victoria Nuland, who was Obama's woman in Ukraine, and she was talking to somebody in the American embassy in Ukraine on the phone, and the phone conversation was leaked by WikiLeaks, and it was her voice, right? And she couldn't deny it, and she didn't deny it, but she actually said in the conversation, she says, fuck the EU. They won't even play their part now after we spending $5 billion organising this coup. We can't even get the EU to play their part. Right? So they admitted organising the coup. And now we have fucking journalists in Ireland who don't even know what happened. I mean, it's unbelievable.
It's very inappropriate, actually, the yeah. conduct, and it's very improper, like, you know, because they just took things, like they made a claim that, you know, we were in trouble in our political group, which yeah. is just utter nonsense. And they used the example of an amendment of ours, which was justly tabled, and more people in our group voted against it or voted for it than against it. So yeah. we're not a minority in our group, and there isn't people going around the European
thing
Parliament.
A little bit factitious anyway. And as you said, Claire, like every detail was made sinister. And there was this thing of like the two of you who are hanging around at the end of the debates to catch extra minutes in debates as if it's something
as if it's
bad,
a crime.
But actually,
because we want to work, it's a crime that we want to work hard.
The problem is there's 700 MEPs who don't even attend the debates, and you actually are trying to participate in debate. So I was just shocked myself when reading that detail and just thinking, how could a European correspondent who can find this information on a website paint that in such a dark light?
But isn't it incredible that the only thing they bother covering is this stuff? I mean, here we have, say, in Ireland, an aviation sector on its knees. I mean, I was given the great honour of opening the European Cockpit Association, the pilots' unions conference there recently, out of, they said, acknowledgement of the work I'd done in raising aviation issues in the Parliament. You know, we had a chance, thanks to initiative we took, there was an emergency resolution tabled in the last plenary about the employment conditions, precarious employment conditions in aviation, precisely because of our intervention. Now, you'd think that the journalists in Ireland, where thousands of jobs are dependent on it, would be following information like that. They couldn't be bothered, you know, and that in and of itself tells you something.
Before I move off from all that, you mentioned, Claire, as well in the podcast about how important Irish neutrality is as well to the two of you and all of your work. And the two of you are Irish MEPs. You raise a lot of issues about imperialism, about the EU not having an independent foreign policy, about towing the American line. Just talk maybe a little bit more about your links or this thing you were saying about being Irish and being an MEP here in a place where there's over 700 MEPs from non-neutral countries as well, NATO-aligned countries, and your role basically and how you see this in your work and what you're doing here.
Well, I mean, I suppose we've made the point before that if anybody wants to be informed, tune in any session to the Security and Defence Committee. Like, for example, we had Vice Admiral Blejean, who was actually a really impressive guy, in to talk about the military planning and capability, MPCC. I can't think what the other C is, but basically this is the sort of, it will be the desire of European military headquarters. And you can see, listening to him, that I suppose the cracks in the situation, that you have forces in the elite in Europe really pushing hard to develop this very strongly centralised European military. And then on the other, you have a number of member states maybe not stepping up to the plate because some of them are wedded to NATO, because some of them have their own domestic issues or whatever. But you only have to look at the trend of where this is going. It is money being pumped into militarism for the first time in our budgets. All of these organisations and acronyms are all leading towards detailed cooperation of our military personnel, which the Irish Defence Forces are very embedded as part of that process. And you want to be stupid not to see that this is going very much in the direction of an EU army, and all of the warnings that were made before and that the people of Ireland followed, and that was the reason for their rejection of many of the treaties, are definitely coming to pass in terms of these projects. In terms of we got a presentation yesterday about them kicking off. And what we have is a securitization and militarization of civilian space. So we have budgets going on medicine, on so-called dealing with the environment, but it's all coming in under military budgets, which is really scary. And it's linked to actually the foreign interference stuff as well. So we speak out
but
about that.
Ireland
all the time.
As a neutral country is letting this happen as a full member of the EU with rights and everything.
And I mean, Ireland has joined a few of these entities like the battle groups and PESCO and that kind of thing, right? But it's becoming obvious now that, I mean, at the time in the Irish Parliament, the Irish government boasted that, oh, we'll have scrutiny over this, we'll have scrutiny over this, we won't have to do anything we don't want to do. That's actually not true now, right? They're actually being dragged into things where there is going to be less and less scrutiny, and they're literally going to be told that this is the way it is, and just get in line. And I mean, what we were that yesterday was that it was military planning and conduct capability, right? And I mean, but there's a whole lot of these different sections, right? And they're all different ways of spending European money. And it's not being challenged at home. I mean, and yet, I mean, we're being criticised for talking about it. People say, I mean, one journalist even said, oh, come on home, Mick, come on home and stop talking about this stuff. Give us a break.
Well, that's our job.
I'm on the Foreign Affairs Committee. I'm on the Security and Defence Committee. It's my work. I'm supposed to be doing it.
Yeah.
I mean, I have a responsibility. And it is connected to what's happening at home. And it does concern the Irish citizens. And that's not been taken on board. We're being dragged in to closer to NATO. We've been dragged into a European Union that's been more and more militarised, spending more and more money on military equipment and defence, that is ratcheting up the anti-China and anti-Russian rhetoric in order to justify this extra spend on arms. And anyone that actually challenges it and says otherwise, oh, misinformation, propaganda, it's fake news. I mean, and we've heard Irish MEPs come out with it. Oh, this is fake news. If it doesn't suit the line of US imperialism, we have MEPs from the right-wing parties here in the European Parliament calling it fake news. That'd make you sick.
It's actually, you know, and there's a real contradiction there, because in a dialogue where they proclaim to be defending democracy against authoritarianism, they're actually involved in authoritarian actions themselves, you know. Mantras that one of the MEPs keeps saying now, he's obviously pocketed now, he thinks it's a great figure, that only 20% of the world live in democracies, as he called it. Who the hell does he think he is? And what does he define as a democracy? Because presumably he's including the whole European Union in that. Has he followed what's gone on in Bulgaria with the corruption and the suppression of people in Hungary, in Poland, the police on the streets of France? For God's sake, for starters, the arrogance of assuming that Europe is in part of it. But also the arrogance in sort of putting your own beliefs or structure of society over whole sections of the globe that have organised their economies and their way of life in a different way. It's just, it is, it's new colonialism, and it's disgusting.
I mean, it is authoritarian if we think that we can tell other countries how to behave. I mean, and if you're talking about democracy, I mean, we obviously... I presume the same individual thinks that America has a democracy where it costs $2 billion to be president, and someone like Bernie Sanders gets shafted. Even when he has the financial backup, he gets shafted by his own Democratic Party because he's not right-wing enough. I mean, is that their idea of democracy?
So the irony is the authoritarianism in the democracy freedom fighters that are saying that we all need liberation, but they're actually shutting down debate left, right and centre. And actually, it's just the whole debate becomes you have to say this or else you're excluded, or what you're saying is ridiculous, or we can't take you seriously. You know,
I mean, authoritarianism is on the rise in Europe, and it's all over the place. And so-called right-wing parties from Ireland who think and journalists who think they're in the centre, which obviously doesn't exist, are actually being authoritarian in their approach to these matters.
Well, it's disgraceful, because the same MEP then went on to, when he was talking about the ransomware attack on the HSE, which by all accounts was carried out by Wizard Spider, a criminal Russian gang, and he inferred that the Russian authorities had something to do with that. Now, that would be a bit like, no one in Ireland is even saying that. So the same fella who's given out about us supposedly spreading fake news is sort of implying his own conspiracy theory without any facts at all. It'd be a bit like saying if the the Kinahans had attacked the Russian health service, that the Irish government was complicit in it because they hadn't dealt with them at home. I mean, it's just utterly shameful. And they wouldn't get away with that remark against any other country, because if the Russian authorities were involved, you could be damn sure that the ambassador would have been hauled in and kicked out by Ireland, never looking for an excuse. But actually, nobody at home even said that. Mm. But he saw fit to introduce that here. And I wouldn't mind, but the same individual, his so-called criticism of us, of using our platform in CETA, which actually the same lazy journalists who replicated, was kind of almost as if they had teed it up between them to get him a bit of publicity. But, you know, it's just, no, look, Nick's laughing at me now, but it was.
Which is true. Yeah. We know that, too. We know it's true.
Yeah, it is true. And now I've forgotten what my point was. Don't do
the
that.
The cases here in that committee, people know about the CETA committee.
Oh, yeah, no, but I was going, yeah, they were saying, like, about us using the CETA committee. I mean, do you think the journalists would follow what we say in the
exactly,
CETA committee? Because
yeah,
the issue he referred to had happened 3 months before, and we were simply asking questions on behalf or to the director of the OPCW. Like, we use CETA to articulate all the things.
The yeah, purpose of having hearings is for MEPs of all different political backgrounds to ask questions. Yeah. You're not there to go on a big like rampage or anything. You're actually there to ask questions and for them to be answered. Do you know? And then if they don't like it, it's fake news.
Yeah,
so
and on the issue of the OPCW, we didn't say that we know what happened. What we do know is that the report of the scientists was buried and a new yeah, one was done by people who didn't go and investigate it. And so we're saying, listen, can we have an investigation and get the whistleblowers' concerns listened to?
Well, I think it's the key thing yeah, is that they said that the report that they did was manipulated. But I mean, crucially, not only that, their claim has been supported by really honourable people like Jose Bastani, the first president of the OPCW, Hans von Sponeck, former UN Assistant General Secretary, our own Dennis Halliday, who was a weapons inspector. So really principled people who were to the forefront of the expose of the fake weapons of mass destruction and dodgy dossiers in Iraq. Same type of thing that's going on here in the demonisation. They have argued for an analysis to be put on this. So it's really, yeah, that's all we've said. We don't know who killed those people.
Yeah.
And we're not saying we do. But all we've said is the scientific level of proof is not there. And the victims of that deserve that. And how in God's name could that be fake news?
Yeah. Which obviously brings us back to Syria. And the big problem with this OPCW story and the reason why the right wing in Europe and Ireland are jumping up and down at the idea that we're challenging the OPCW narrative is because this is actually crucial
yeah,
for them.
Yeah.
Because it exposes the fake news that they have spun on Syria for 10 years. And it exposes the fact that while it wasn't a civil war between people within Syria, we had jihadists from outside the country being armed by the Americans, by the Israelis, by the Saudis and the Europeans, unfortunately, to bring about regime change in Syria. And this is part of the equation. And a week after that reported chemical attack in Douma, this was in 2018, April 2018, a week after that, America, France and the UK illegally bombed Syria. It said, oh, there's a chemical attack. We're bombing you again, right? It's a war crime, right? And they don't want that truth. The truth is hugely problematic for them.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting on the subject of I suppose, fake news and the sort of one-sided analysis of the Irish media. I mean, we were really surprised and sort of laughing at the fact that the our own Foreign Affairs Committee at home had your woman Tiganoska in, the so-called Belarusian president in waiting. So the Irish doll now and the European Union is going to recognise the president. They'll be having Juan Guaido in next, like, to tell us he's the president of Venezuela. But I mean, I mean,
the same one, right? She's been before the Foreign Affairs Committee 3 times,
here,
right?
Yeah.
And I mean, it wasn't hard to tear strips off her, right? You wouldn't put her out for your rob, right? I mean, it's a joke, like. I mean, this one's been put forward now to support the Western narrative. And she's actually sat down, right? Before she even came to the Parliament the first time, she had sat down with the Americans and discussed the whole thing. I mean, and then they try to make out that she's not a puppet of the West.
But I mean, they're all desperately looking for our opinion on this now, right? I bet they haven't desperately looked for the opinions of other Irish MEPs on whether she's appearing before the Dáil or not. And what that is part of a sort of an insidious inference that we somehow support Lukashenko, which we don't. And nobody can find anywhere where we did. And we only had discussion this week in the Parliament at his latest antics now, which which has the parliament in a spiral, whereby Lukashenko, in response to the ratcheting up of the sanctions on Belarus, he's responded now by basically opening up his borders to allow refugees to transit through Belarus in through Lithuania. And Lithuanian and Latvian and Polish MEPs are apoplectic, even though, you know, the commission pointed out and the EU that there's no way they're going to settle in those countries or would dream of it, which is a lesson in and of itself, but that they'd probably use it to transit through to Germany. Now, Lukashenko, what he has done is that being very smart now, all right, like he has opened up travel to Belarus for people who want to get the vaccine for 5 days without a visa to 70 countries. And you can only imagine where those 70 countries are. So what you had was a load of Africans and Iraqis arriving into Belarus to go on their way to Europe. But let's get it. So that's reprehensible. He is using vulnerable people in his game with the Europe, which has nothing got to do with those vulnerable refugees. We have Europe responding as if, you know, it was the end of the world. 1,600 people now. That's all there's been. But they go, that's not the point. Yeah. It's 22% increase or 22 times increase. Rubbish. You know, they're tiny numbers in the overall scale of things, and they're not going to stay in those countries. And then America came in to say they were keeping an eye on it. Like, what has that got to do with America other than the fact that it was their foreign policy that probably caused those people to flee in the first place? So what we're saying is the response to the situation in Belarus is not to play the game of treating human beings as pawns. Give those people their proper legal rights and their rights to asylum. That's what the EU should be worried about. If we're the ones defending human rights and you're criticising about Belarus not doing it, and then sit down and deal with these issues properly with our European neighbours, because this tit-for-tat sanction thing is going nowhere. Well, but yeah, we don't support Lukashenko. Yeah. We were very clear on it and that money, but we're not going to go along with the EU's hypocrisy either. And it's not up to the EU to appoint their president.
Let's move on and talk about Cuba, because that's in the news as of late. The situation in Cuba with all the protesters on the streets. Go on, Mick, tell us what's actually happening there.
Yeah.
Because I mean, honestly, the coverage, I think, has been really shocking.
It has. Yeah. I mean, you have a few hundred people on the streets protesting about conditions in Cuba. And God knows, I'm sure conditions are very tough in Cuba because of the sanctions. And the US have had sanctions on Cuba now for almost 70 years. 60 years, and since 1960, 61. And they're illegal. Mm. And they're a collective punishment against the people of Cuba. And they're designed to make the people of Cuba want to force the government out. In other words, to bring about the regime change they want. And I mean, it just exposes Biden that he's actually ratcheting it up even from where it was with Trump. I mean, it's just mad. Now, it should be said that the majority of European countries don't agree with the American sanctions. That at the UN last month, 184 countries called for an end to the US sanctions on Cuba. 184 countries, only two countries.
Can you guess who? Yeah,
you get no marks for guessing which two, right? Yeah. But I mean, it's so blatant. And I mean, then Borrell comes out this week and he says, oh, the people of Cuba have the right to protest. And there was protests shown in The Guardian, The Washington Post, New York Times, and they showed demonstrations of the Cubans supporting the government, and they were represented as these were the protest of people opposing the government, because there's only a few hundred opposing it.
I've only seen the same video.
There was a protest in somewhere in Florida where obviously there's a huge anti-Cuban section, right? And there was a protest of that shown, and they pretended that it was actually in Cuba as well. I mean, it's unbelievable. Like, this is fake news.
It's
really worrying, like, that they would ratchet it up against the country who are struggling to deal with the aftermath of the pandemic. And let's, even despite their own struggles in that regard, they came up with 5, I think, vaccines. They sent their doctors to 40 countries around the world and sent their medicines and their assistance. They've been brilliant in terms of international solidarity and the economic I suppose, effects of the sanctions and the health crisis have made life even more difficult. It's never been a bed of roses, but it's even more difficult as they try and withstand the assault from US imperialism. But that they would step in now and try and ratchet this up is really despicable. And yeah. I think one of the things we were talking about would seem that some on the left in Ireland have kind of, well, I don't really agree with the position that they've taken. Well, not really. I don't agree at all. I mean, they've taken the opportunity to sort of make a point of criticising the Cuban government, a bit like Borrell, or, you know, saying they're not, they don't support the Cuban government, but they support the people. But actually, it's the Cuban government at the moment that the US are trying to undermine. So if they get away with that, it'll be an, it'll have a negative impact on the people. You know, it's a bit like, you know, if you, you're not getting on with your neighbour and you really hate him or whatever, but you see him being beaten up or whatever by somebody else, you don't take the time to say, now, I don't really agree with you. You've been annoying me with your music too loud, but I don't agree with that fella beating you. Do you know what I mean? It's, there's a time and a place for criticism. And when the Cuban government is under a sustained assault, an attempted coup in the making, whether they'll get that far, it's not the time to sort of highlight those differences, you know?
Exactly. Oh, like the whole thing is online as well. It's SOS Cuba and all these hashtags and petitions for, like, can you actually believe there's petitions going around for US humanitarian intervention in Cuba? Now, just have a think for a second there, because the Cuban people are actually very educated, surprise, surprise, to most people. They're actually very, they have a fantastic education system and they know their history. They know what their context is. They know where their conditions come from. They live under an embargo where they can't buy things on an international market. So the material problems there at the moment are energy shortages. They're having blackouts all the time, food shortages and medicines. And obviously there's COVID keeps coming back and back and they have to do more lockdowns. It's quite bad. Mm. Now, put two and two together, I don't think the average Cuban is going around saying this damn government that we live under, this horrible regime, is, it's all you. Like, come on. Like, it's just an insult to them. Like,
and people should know and realize that not only are human rights weaponized more and more by the European countries, by the EU and the Americans in the last number of years, but humanitarian aid doesn't come clean, and it comes with strings attached, and there's always a geopolitical nature to it now, and that people should remember.
And it was really,
that.
Really disappointing that Ireland and Norway spearheaded and made a virtue out of this, of pushing the UN Security Council to keep open that road into Syria and so-called defending humanitarian aid getting through. The reality
is, it's
total nonsense. Like, that aid is hijacked by the jihadists who predominate, and that's
it
not.
It is literally. It's
going to keep them there.
Yeah, it's helping to continue the conflict in Syria because it's going to the jihadists. Most of it is going through on the Idlib region.
It's just a reality.
And they refuse to, if they're actually concerned about the people of Syria, they'd let it go through the proper channels and they would go through the Syrian government, which is a sovereign government recognized by the UN.
But of course,
not recognized by several MEPs from Ireland.
Like with Cuba, if we actually care about the conditions in Cuba, it's about the embargo. We should be, like, there's no point saying solidarity with the protesters. Blah blah blah.
That's the thing. Like, while you're squeezing them and with sanctions and all this kind of thing. Oh, we want to get humanitarian aid, but meanwhile we're going to prevent the economy from redeveloping, so we're going to strangle them anyway. Like, you know, it's
like,
kind of nonsense.
It's illegal. Like, why can't we, like, focus our energy against that?
I think it would be like, you know, it's just mad. But I mean, look, I think it'd be remiss as our last programme to finish without mentioning sort of developments.
Football.
Well, no, I was leaving that to you at the end.
I was waiting to see
that's
going to
happen.
How could we get this far into the podcast without mentioning football? Are you two Philistines? What's wrong with you people?
What planet do you live on? We knew you were going to do that. But before we do, and we wanted to get in another really important issue, which is the fact that the Disclosures Tribunal publication came out during the week, 900 pages into the allegations of Gerda Nick Keogh. Now, the first thing to say is it took them a year to publish it. Interesting. Don't know why it was so long. Not much in the media about it. And I've only started to read the 900 pages, so I'm not going to go into the details of it. The tribunal said that they didn't really uphold Nick Keogh's allegations, but they did say he was very honourable, a person who was under a lot of stress, that, you know, his claims were made in good faith. But we're not going to go into the details of it. But what we would say is that it seems to me that this report was very narrowly interpreted in terms of the terms of reference. And it's important to say to people, because one of the newspapers said, oh, TDs in the Dáil banding around allegations that weren't proven, fake news, fake news. God almighty, here we go. Donald Trump is alive and well. Let's be clear here. The allegations of wrongdoing and criminality were not investigated by the tribunal, the claims made by Nick Keogh. The tribunal was also clear that it didn't have a supervising role in the investigations of Gardaí or in Garda conduct. The only thing they were looking at was whether Nick Keogh was victimised as a result of making the protected disclosure. Now, not whether he was victimised or not, that wasn't even into, but whether he was victimised and targeted as a result of making a protected disclosure. So that's a very, very narrow, I suppose, interpretation and hard to prove. So we just want to put on the record that, as far as we're concerned, Nick Keogh is one of the best people we've ever had the privilege of working with. We certainly stand over everything that we've said in the course of this, and we would, you know, lay down whatever we could to work with Nick again, and we wish him all the best. What he did was really heroic, and it's been a privilege for us to work with him.
We engaged with Nick for several years in the Dáil. He was amazing, he was, right? He was so straight and honest about everything. Mm. And I'd say he didn't tell us one lie. He didn't give us any lead just that would support his cause that wasn't 100% accurate. He was amazing, right? And anything that we said in relation to his story is in the Dáil is 100% true. But as Claire has pointed out, the terms of reference were very, very tight, and the tribunal carried out its work. And while I haven't read the report either yet, I am sure that they did what they did within the terms of reference, and that's fair enough. But we can't blame them that the terms of reference were what they were. But it doesn't change the fact that Nick has played a very, very positive role, just as Maurice McCabe did,
and John Wilson
in highlighting, and other guards too,
absolutely,
right? But in highlighting the fact that we had serious problems in An Garda Síochána, and we'd like to think that things will be done better. Now, everything's not perfect yet, but we do think there's a public expectation that things should be done better, things should be done different. And these whistleblowers deserve enormous credit for what they did. Mm. Because you know what? Whether you're in the OPCW, or whether you're in the Garda Síochána, whether you're in the health service, being a whistleblower is not easy anywhere.
Yeah.
In any country in the world, it has remained a lonely place for everybody. And fair play to all the whistleblowers. And obviously, I just hope Nick can see it in the positive light and realise and take on board the massive contribution that he's made to Irish society.
Yeah. Very good. That's it for our episode today. Then
what do you mean? Hold on a minute now.
Listen, go on.
Listen, let's try and keep our priorities in order, right?
Well, you're finishing
I've missed one tournament in the last 40 years, right? And as people know, I mean, apart from being an Irish football supporter, I also am a massive Italian supporter. And I've seen four of Italy's games in the stadium this time around. It was a very difficult tournament to get to the games because of COVID, because of the fact that it had been played in 12 different cities, which is absolute nonsense. And it was something that Platini was responsible for about 6 years ago in order to get votes and to try and keep everybody happy by giving a bit of the tournament to everybody. But it was a mad scheme. But it was a great tournament. And people really bought into it. And the Italians were beautiful. They were just so good. And I mean, I enjoyed them so much. I've got so much pleasure from watching Italy in the last couple of weeks. And it has just given me so much pleasure. I'll never forget it. And it was wonderful. Listen, I've been a big fan of Italian football all my life, and they don't always do themselves justice. But having said that, since I started following football, Italy have been in four World Cup finals, right? And in that time, people should remind us, England were in one before that when they got to the final in London in 66. And it's the only tournament they've ever won. They told us that football was coming home for the last few weeks. But it's coming home, all right. Yeah, it's coming home to Italy. And thanks be to,
years of hurt, thanks be to God for that.
But I have to say, just talking about the final on Sunday, right? I mean, I have been to so much football all my life. I've rarely seen so much hostility and aggression in a city as I saw last Sunday, and the hostility and aggression in the stadium. And I want to point out that I found that the majority of people that I met and came across were of more of a middle-class background than working-class. I've seen very few out-and-out working-class in the stadium. But I just don't understand it. There's something seriously wrong from a societal point of view in Britain, that people would behave like this. The racism shown towards the Italians all day on the streets.
The aggressiveness.
I mean, it was just mad. And I mean, listen, there was a fantastic atmosphere in the stadium from the point of view of there was incredible noise, and it was a cauldron and an incredibly hostile place for the Italian team as well. And to lay in a goal after 2 minutes and then spend the rest of the game dominating the match and just trying to get it back. They outpassed the English by over 2-1. They had more than twice as many attempts on goal. They had 62% possessions against 38. It was a one-sided match, right? But it was an amazing game in terms of intensity and the whole lot. And my God,
the penalties.
Oh my God. And I mean, listen, the English players that missed the penalties have got an awful lot of abuse, which is totally wrong. I think the management made a mistake in sending young fellas to take him. But having said that, I mean, you had someone like Jorginho missing it for Italy, right? Yeah. He's an old chap, right? He's been around a while and a really experienced player. The pressure on the penalty takers on Sunday, from my experience, and I've been to 19 tournaments in total, right? The pressure, 20 tournaments, the pressure on last Sunday was probably the most intensive pressure I've ever seen. And when the English guy went up to take the last one, it was Saka. I mean, he was only a chap. He's 19, right? Yeah. I mean, I actually didn't expect him to score. It had just become too difficult to score.
Mm.
And Donnarumma, of course, the nerves weren't with him. Mm. He couldn't wait for the ball to be sent at him so he could save it, right?
Yeah.
But it was very, very difficult to score penalties last Sunday. The pressure was so great on both sides. But my God, the relief. You have no idea what it was like, the relief. I mean, not only was it so beautiful and wonderful for Italy to win the European Championships, but to beat England and to beat them in London.
Everyone was Italian. We have loads of ideas.
We've been listening to you all week. We know. But no, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, the English media have a lot to responsibility as well in hyping this up, but I think it will be the subject of future studies. And I think to emphasize the point you made, because if people remember back to the undercover investigations into football hooliganism in the UK, the people perpetrating that were wealthy people, stockbroker types, like, you know, and it was a sort of an organized, violent movement. And I think the point that it's not coming from working class Britain is very important, because I think there'll be sections of society which try to spin it like that. We've had people here trying to claim it as a victory for the European Union. For feck's sake, the same countries that'll be shafting Italy left, right and centre, now suddenly it's a victory for the European Union. It isn't. It's a victory for Italian football, although I do think everybody was cheering for them this time round.
Well, Sinead, I think that's it now for the football. We'll park that.
Arrivederci, Roma.
I have to say now, the football didn't really get the time slot in this podcast as it should have. But you look at the, no point in me complaining. I'm kind of playing third place fiddle here anyway, most of the time.
Sure thing.
I'm barely getting a word in. Francois, did you ever check to see who's doing all the talking on this podcast? Because I think I get the short straw most weeks.
I think the people should vote and let us know.
Exactly.
Anyway, thanks for listening.
Have a lovely summer, everybody. We will see you back in the autumn.
Yeah. Ciao, ciao.
Ci vediamo, ci vediamo.
Arrivederci.
Keep on listening to TRP.